Hello and welcome to Dialect.
I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. It's been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2, though, every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, Chris Pothecary, our Columbia correspondent, is back after about 6 months and he's about to head back over to the country. He reports on the recent peace deal with the FARC guerrillas. And we speak to Fran Anderson from reinvestigate911.org, 15 years after the deadly attacks on America. But who by? Dialect is produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. You can also go through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That's one word if you're online, volunteerbristol.org.uk. Or the National do-it.org. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show.
My name is Fran Anderson. I'm from Reinvestigate 911, which is a UK-based organisation. And we're seeking a truly independent reinvestigation into the 9/11 attacks.
Now, I know you're speaking from Hackney. Is this something that you think that is still current in London? Because it's 15 years since these attacks.
Well, yes, I do think that, Tony, because we're still living in a changed world. Since 9/11 happened, things have changed. We've got the war on terror, which is never ending and forever going on. We've got perpetual wars. And look at the wars that we went to immediately after 9/11 with Afghanistan and Iraq, which the UK joined in. I mean, look at the results and the consequences of that, of the complete chaos in the Middle East, which has bred the groundwork for ISIS, you know, for Islamic State to come about. I mean, you know, I'm sure Islamic State would not have come about if it hadn't been for that complete chaos that the West has caused in Afghanistan, Iraq and Libya and Syria.
Now, what about at the time we were told that this chap called Osama bin Laden was behind the 9/11 attacks? He was supposedly, I mean, I'm not sure how many people believe this nowadays, but apparently he was in a cave in Bora Bora in Afghanistan, and he was planning the attacks on New York and Washington from there.
Well, there's an awful lot of unanswered questions when it comes to Osama bin Laden. I mean, for a start, the bin Ladens have got some very strong links with the Bush family, with business links with the Bush family. Osama bin Laden has also got links with Saudi royal family and the Saudi government. So who was he working for, really? Was he a double agent? Who knows? I mean, it's a lot of unanswered questions about Osama bin Laden. Certainly, somebody could not orchestrate the 9/11 attacks from a cave in Bora Bora, because it's a very sophisticated operation that would have taken months of planning, months of logistics, a hell of a lot of money. And, you know, I'm sorry, it doesn't wash. Osama bin Laden could not have planned those attacks, if he did at all plan those attacks. He says he didn't. How could he have done it from a cave?
Well, that's a good question. But I understand on September the 11th, if we go back 15 years itself, that one of the most immediate things that happened is that all aircraft in the United States were grounded for at least 24 hours, except one, apparently.
That's right. The only one that was allowed to fly out of the US, not just an internal flight, was a plane laden with Saudi officials and Saudi royal family, including relatives of the prime suspect, Osama bin Laden. Why was it being allowed to fly out and they weren't even being questioned by anybody? That's highly suspicious. It was like, quick, get them out the country. You know, this is embarrassing. That's what it looks like.
Okay, so this campaign you're part of, Reinvestigate 9/11, why do you think it's necessary? Because there is all sorts of information out there on the internet, isn't there? You know, some conspiracy theories saying that there are maybe Saudis involved, etc. So there's a lot of different theories out there. Why do you think we need another investigation? We've already had one.
Well, because the 9/11 Commission, which was the official investigation, is full of flaws, as Professor David Ray Griffin points out in his book, excellent book, 9/11 Commission Omission. They were directed by Bush insider Philip Zelikow exactly what to write on the report. And also Philip Zelikow had an awful lot of influence behind the scenes. So they weren't allowed to delve in certain issues. And they were told not to look at Saudi connections. We were told, the official version is, the 9/11 Commission has said, oh, we investigated the Saudi connections, but there wasn't any truth in the allegations. Well, we've seen that that's not true now with this, declassified 28-page report that came out this year. I mean, that shows that the 9/11 commissioner was lying. I mean, there were Saudi connections. They didn't bother to investigate because they were being told by the Bush administration, don't go there.
So were the 9/11 attacks carried out by Saudi Arabia Intelligence Service, the royal family, the government, people connected to them? Is it just that simple?
I don't think it's that simple, Tony, because I think the whole thing is quite complicated. And that's why we don't tend to theorise who may have done it. We tend to look at the evidence and the facts and where it leads us and how the anomalies of the official version are just, well, it's just full of holes.
OK, so, well, 15 years after, what would you point to as the main holes in the official account then?
Well, at the moment, the latest that's come out is, as I said, thanks to former Democratic Senator Bob Graham, who sat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, and he was also on the 9/11 Commission. And he's been a key critic of the official investigation into 9/11. And he's fought for many years to have a declassified chapter of the 9/11 report and of additional materials relating to 9/11 to be released to the public domain. And it was released in July this year, July the 15th, 2016. They released the declassified 28 pages, but with 97 redactions in it. You know, so it's far from what people want, because people don't want the redactions. They want to see what is redacted. Mr. Graham characterized the FBI as moving, I'm quoting him, beyond a cover-up to an aggressive deception in which they rewrote the narrative for the 9/11 attacks. Now, that's quite a strong criticism of the official version of events.
So what came out in these 28 pages we didn't already know?
Well, it showed a web of links to Saudi government officials, Saudi royal family members and suspected Saudi intelligence operatives that were within the US at the time, and the 9/11 hijackers. On page one, it shows links to the Saudi Prince Bandar, who was the ambassador to the United States. He made payments to a supporter of Osama bin Laden. This supporter of Osama bin Laden boasted of helping the two Flight 77 hijackers in San Diego. And in a phone book of an al-Qaeda associate, Abu Zudaybah, there was a phone number linked to Prince Bandar and a phone number for a bodyguard at the Saudi embassy in Washington who was under FBI investigation. And very crucially, the FBI never showed up to interview a top 9/11 suspect. And an FBI assessment has been mentioned in the 28 pages of a Saudi national, Omar al-Bayoumi, as a likely intelligence officer for Riyadh, who facilitated support, including flight training, for at least two of the 19 hijackers living in San Diego. And Bayoumi left the US in the summer of 2001, and he went to Birmingham in England. He was taken into custody after 9/11 at the FBI's request. But the UK couldn't hold him for more than a certain amount of days by law. And the FBI never showed up to interview Bayoumi, yet he was a key suspect. And during that time, he was released from custody and left for Saudi Arabia. So this is a clear, you know, negligence by the FBI there, a chief suspect, and they've let him go.
What about the basic premise that the United States Air Force did not really react very well to this attack, because we have four planes apparently flying around, zigzagging their way around America, and yet there is supposed to be a response from the Air Force, isn't there?
Well, yes, exactly. It's very suspicious because there was a lot of operations going on that day, mock exercises, mock terrorist exercises, and the people in the flight control rooms are saying that they didn't know whether it was real life or exercise, because there's all these blips all over the place reported of planes going out of control on 9/11. And a lot of the blips were from the exercises that were running that day. And it doesn't seem like any coincidence, does it? That particular day had an incredible amount. I can't remember the figure, but, you know, it's well over 10 different exercises running that day.
Well, what's the role of an exercise then? If there's a real terrorist attack going on, why is it significant that there's exercises on the same day? You might actually think that an exercise would help because the military, the police, the government forces or whoever are a bit more prepared than they would be otherwise.
Well, to a certain extent, that may be true because FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Association, were having emergency meetings in New York in near the Twin Towers at the time with some exercise that they were undertaking. So, yes, they happened to be on the scene at the time. So that's true in that case. But when it came to the planes, so many planes had been reported to be off course, and some of them weren't real planes. They were just blips inserted into the radar by these exercise drills like Vigilant Guardian and I can't remember the names of the others. But I mean, that's one of the reasons why, or supposedly one of the reasons why, some of the intercept planes were sent in the wrong direction. Instead of sending them to New York or Pennsylvania or Washington, they were being sent across the Atlantic, completely the opposite direction.
So what's your advice for people who are interested in getting to the bottom of the 9/11 attacks? Because clearly the media in Washington, United States and in London and most parts of the Western world hasn't really done a proper, shall we say, panorama style, world in action style, you know, Roger Cook style, if I could dare say, investigation into this. It almost seems as if the events are so long ago now that maybe that will never happen.
Good question. Maybe it will never happen. But even if it never happens, I think it's important that people question the official version and they look at the research themselves. And, of course, there's some very good quality research out there on the internet. There's, for a start, there's the www.28pages.com, which is quite a new one, which is dedicated to the 28 pages and other documents that Senator Bob Graham and the 9/11 Families Campaign are trying to push for a release of, because it looks very suspicious that the CIA were actually protecting the hijackers. I mean, we've got whistleblowers from the CIA and from the FBI saying that their superiors were lent on by somebody else above them to stand off from actually arresting some of these hijackers before 9/11.
Now, some people say that if it was to have been a conspiracy 9/11, that someone would have said something in the meantime. Well, clearly they have. It's just that the media haven't really reported it. But look, finally, Frank, could you give us some few tips? Because one of the easiest ways to look into this is to look at the documentaries that the BBC, ITV and Channel 4 are not showing us. But some of them are there, very easy to watch on the internet. Can you recommend a few?
Well, yes, there's the architects and engineers from 9/11 Truth have produced some really good ones. So go on their website and you will see that they've got some YouTube videos. And also Reinvestigate 9/11.org YouTube channel. We've got quite a lot of videos where we filmed our speakers at our conference speaking about all sorts of aspects of the 9/11 attacks. Also, the Italians did a good one, Tony. Can you remember the name of it?
Zero?
Yes, it could be Zero. I'd recommend that people do their own research and come to their own conclusions.
I mean, if you plug your computer into the telly, you can watch these things quite easily. There's also another one very well known called Loose Change Dylan Avery. But is there any one of these films that you've found particularly good?
I think one of the Loose Change ones, the one with Michael Meacher in it, I thought that was good. The fact that we had a top politician in the UK, Michael Meacher, saying that Al-Qaeda meant the base, you know, the CIA, it clearly showed, you know, he was talking about how the CIA had helped to set up, train and fund Al-Qaeda. And that's been well documented, not just by Michael Meacher. Even Tony Benn mentioned it, Tony Benn MP, and some other investigative journalists like Peter Dale Scott and some others. So it's been well documented, the links between the CIA, the Al-Qaeda, and now, of course, we've got Islamic State. I mean, Islamic State probably wouldn't exist if it hadn't been for all these illegal wars that we went to. And let's not forget, they tried so hard to blame Iraq for 9/11 to the extent that they were willing to torture a detainee called Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, you know, to actually say that there were links between Iraq and 9/11 when there weren't any. And that was used in the preparation for Colin Powell's speech at the UN in 2003, justifying the war in Iraq. So to use torture in that way, I mean, torture is bad enough, but to use it deliberately to make somebody actually make a link that isn't there. I mean, this is heinous. And we've got Ali Soufan, whose ex-FBI has said that the torture of Al-Qaeda suspects was part of the Iraq invasion plan.
So really, the fact is that it's not as if there haven't been whistleblowers. There have been scores and scores of them. It's just that they haven't been reported by the press in London and in the US. Also, we've got quite a lot of baggage from this, the war on terror. But look, at the end of the day, do you think it really matters to reinvestigate the September 11th attack? What difference could it make, Fran?
I think it does make a difference because it shows how far the Bush administration, and that means any other administration after it, how far they're willing to go to lie to justify and perpetuate their own foreign policy when they know it wouldn't be popular with people. So this is how far they're willing to go, to lie, to cover up. I mean, even if the official 9/11 story was true, I mean, to use torture in that way, it's just beggars belief how far they stooped, the Bush administration. And, you know, it shows that you cannot trust the official version of any event anymore. And I think people are realizing that now when they're seeing the footage of what's going on in the world now with Syria, with Libya. We're practically being told lies all the time. So I think 9/11 is crucial because that's where the biggest lies started happening. And they thought they could get away with 9/11, and they're still lying today. And what's disgusting is the UK is going along with all these lies. So you can find the Reinvestigate 9/11 website at www.reinvestigate911.org.
Fran Anderson from Hackney in London, reinvestigate911.org. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you very much, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name's Chris Pothicherry. Been on the show before. I'm talking about Colombia, and that was about 6 months ago. So I've been in England all of this time. I haven't gone back to Colombia yet, and I thought I'd, come along today and
well, it's
speak
a, good
a
idea
little bit more about the developments.
You have, because I understand you're back off to Colombia again soon.
Yeah.
So do you miss it?
I do, yeah. I love Colombia. Colombia's a great place and very lively people. And there's a lot to see and a lot to do in Colombia, and amazing What landscapes.
What is it that you most miss about it when you're back here in Britain?
The countryside. I love the countryside. Colombia is a beautiful country. And there's the area where I live in Colombia is up in the mountains, so it's cloud forest. Amazing, spectacular views, a lot of deep valleys, canyons, a lot of different kinds of wildlife. Then you can go down into the Amazon jungle as well in Colombia. There's deserts in Colombia. You've got the Andes. So it's a very spectacular country with a big range of different kinds of ecosystems. It's actually, for its size, it's the most biodiverse country in the world. Only Brazil is more biodiverse, but Brazil is much bigger. So if you were to do it by size, Colombia would be the most biodiverse country in the world.
It sounds to me like lots of little creepy crawlies and snakes.
Oh, yes.
Snakes as well.
Loads. Snakes, insects, lizards, butterflies. It's got the greatest range of butterflies in the world, apparently. Fish as well. There's a huge variety of fish and birds of all kinds of colours and shapes and sizes.
So have you ever had a close encounter with anything a bit nasty out
I've
in the...
had close encounters with various snakes in Colombia, yes. I was taught by one of a local woman out there how to actually catch a snake. And so I've actually caught a wild snake and handled it, a poisonous one, which consists of getting a V-shaped stick and catching it behind the head. And then you have to get it and get your thumb on the head and make sure it doesn't get out of your grasp, because then they would probably try and bite you. And I've had very close encounter with a very big snake in the jungle. I don't believe it was a poisonous snake. It was about 3 meters long. I've seen a boa constrictor as well. So, yeah.
See, they don't need to bite you, do they? They just squeeze you to death.
No, they apparently, yeah. I mean, this was a young boa constrictor, so they wouldn't necessarily go for a human being, I don't think. But, it's amazing to see a creature like that alive and wild in the jungle.
Oh, sounds like the Jungle Book, the old cartoon from the 60s. Anyway, look, you're heading off there soon, but there's been some quite big developments over the last few weeks in Colombia. That is to say, apparently a peace deal signed between the government and the FARC guerrillas.
Well, they've been negotiating that for the last 6 years, and the present government in Colombia, which is under the presidency of a fellow called Juan Manuel Santos. He is in charge of Colombia at the moment, and his government have been negotiating with the FARC for the past 6 years. And recently, they signed, on the same day as the Brexit result in Britain, they signed a kind of a pre-deal, kind of like, okay, that they were going into the last stage of the deal. And now in the last few days, I've heard that they've actually signed a deal in which the FARC are now committing to giving their arms in.
But look, just give us an idea of the two sides. The FARC is one side. They're Marxist guerrillas. They're not really part of the government, but they're certainly, they have an income from drug dealing and all sorts of other potential ways of making money. And so it's almost like there's two gangs. There's the government gang and the FARC gang. Is that fair to say?
I think as things have developed over time, it's probably become more like that. In my knowledge of the history of Colombia, from speaking to people there and also, you know, reading and just learning about it, living there, that the original movement of the guerrilla armies in Colombia was, I think, a very authentic expression that had arisen from a lot of persecution of the people by the ruling classes. The fact that then it's over time it has become more and more politicized and has been the sort of an expression of Marxist ideology, that's something that's come in over time, I think. But if you go to the grassroots of it and you speak to grassroots people who are there living in the jungles or whatever, and maybe they're affiliated in some way with that organization, they're not quite so much into ideology. They're much more into what are the basic needs that they have that are not being attended to by the state. So you know, there are genuine grievances and necessities in the people in Colombia that have led to that situation occurring. But, I mean, the FARC have over the years become very involved in the drug trade. And that, I don't think, has done them any good in many ways, because it's I remember noticing that a lot of the younger people, I lived in an area of Colombia for a while, which was where the FARC were in control. So if you live in an area like that, occasionally you'll see them. They're not visible all of the time, but they've got people who are working for them all of in all of the villages and so on. So, you know, if anything goes on, they'd know about it.
So, I mean, we're talking about a kind of almost like a territory controlled by the FARC. How would you know, for example, if you'd gone from government-controlled area into a FARC area?
If you are travelling around in Colombia, you need to know. There's certain zones, and they're called red zones. Now, there are zones, or there were back in the day, zones which are genuinely guerrilla-controlled zones. There were other zones which, if you were to speak to someone in the capital city in Bogota, a taxi driver or any person on the streets, or even a policeman, they would say, such and such an area is a red zone, don't go there. But that, a lot of the time, would often be propaganda because it wasn't necessarily the case. Indeed, I went to areas like that and there was nothing at all and there was no real guerrilla presence there, but it was rumoured to be so, and therefore that kept people away from those areas. I'm not, you know, sure what was the, you know, that was something that would be put out by the government.
So yeah. would you notice if you were crossing from a government-controlled part of Colombia to a FARC control? Is it, say, for example, at night time or whatever, in a bus, a coach or something, is there a checkpoint, or is it just suddenly you're in a different area?
The areas which have been traditionally FARC-controlled, those areas would be very, very seldom visited by any person that isn't Colombian, for a start. Now, if you go into the areas, the only thing that you would really be able to tell the difference is there's no police stations. There's not really an army presence. Yeah. But on the way, in the particular areas that I knew, right up until an hour away from an area which is FARC controlled, there would be army checkpoints, fortified police stations, because the police stations would have fences around them, barricades, sandbags, a whole installation for protection, as if they were. And often you'd see bullet marks on the walls and so on, whether it'd be some kind of skirmish or if the FARC had gone and attacked them at some point. So then, once you were moving away from that area, I mean, I always travelled, and it would be advisable in those situations to always travel with a local person who knows the score, because you could find yourself in an area like that, and if you don't know the situation in the country, you wouldn't necessarily know immediately that it was an area that was FARC-controlled.
But so you're in a FARC-controlled area. Let's just imagine there's no police, there's no army. Does that mean it's lawless?
No, not at all. I mean, they are the law in those areas, and they have their own system of justice, or they had, because now they're going to disband. But in those times, you know, and I think, you know, there's a lot of, for example, one area that I travelled to a few years ago was an area in which you needed to have letters of recommendation on your person if you were to travel in deep into those areas, because they were areas which were much more sensitive. So you would need to actually make investigations before you travelled in those areas, and to have some kind of backup.
Sounds a bit hairy. I mean, you know, but still you want to go back.
Yeah, I mean, it's not as hairy as you'd think it is. It sounds it, but I know if you speak, I speak fluent Spanish, so I know the country very well. I've studied the geography. I've studied the history. I can make myself understood very clearly. So, and I kind of know the nature of the people, and I've picked up a lot of the local words in the dialects. So I can sort of I wouldn't ever play out pass myself off as Colombian. I'm a little bit too white and tall and things like that. But people over there are very much like, well, if you do pick up all of those kind of things and you're, I mean, you'll always be a gringo, and they'll say, ah, he's a gringo, no? But if you are able to integrate well with the people, and you're sociable and so on, people will very quickly warm to you. And it's not necessarily a tremendous difficulty, those things. You just have to have your wits about you.
But, okay. So you're outside of kind of the normal system. Where you're living, you have to do all the normal things like have credit card, pay rent, and all that sort of stuff.
Well, I mean, I've been living on a farm in a rural area, so we don't have. There's an electric. We do have electricity, Although that would tend to go down as soon as there's a storm or anything like that, and would disappear for 3 days or so. So it's quite regular power cuts. Yeah, when you're living in those parts of Colombia, for example, if you bought a piece of land and you've built a house on it, and you need to get electricity. The electricity board will send you up a concrete post, and you've got to work out how to put the thing up into the ground. Yeah, so the people there are very clever with levers and. Ropes and all, and they know how to do it. So you get some local people to help you to do it. But the electricity board will only come on and put the wires on once you've got everything ready. So you know it's quite different to here. I mean, obviously in Colombia they work a system of credit cards. You can go into the villages and because most people don't get internet in their houses over there, the place is full of internet cafes. So any town will have 10, 15, 20 internet cafes, and that is the way that you get on the internet. Mobile phones in Colombia, because people are always scrimping to get by, it is very normal that virtually in every street, five, six, seven people have got a sign outside the house saying minutes for sale. So if you want to give someone a call and you haven't got a mobile phone with minutes, because a lot of people might have a phone but they won't have the money to buy minutes or to buy a plan. So they can receive calls, but when they need to make a call, they're going to have to go someone who's bought a plan and they're selling minutes.
And I do wonder sometimes whether the Brits are missing a trick here, because we all pay for our internet, don't we? A whole street of people individually. Well, actually, if a whole street was to get together, they could have one big fat internet connection and share it between them all.
Indeed.
And yeah. I suppose that's the necessity.
And that would be more sociable, because I think in a lot of ways, you know, part of the thing, and I notice it living in Britain again, is that the more that we all have our own access to the internet and with the apps on the phones and everything, the less that we need to interact physically with other people. Mm. So, you know, you take out the sociability, and it's actually more difficult to get to know people. And to make friends,
well,
you know,
because we lose our social skills. Oh dear,
yeah, exactly.
Oh dear. I was just thinking the other day, actually, about the, you know, demise of the railways in the 1960s, and less use of the train and more use of the car. Mm-hmm. That's another way of desocialising people.
Yeah.
You're not chatting to people on the train. You're sitting in the car most of the time on your own, driving to and from work, spending hours and hours and hours in a little box, maybe listening to the radio.
You see, I mean, I think one of the things that's really going to happen in Colombia now, and is happening, is that, although Colombia's been in this conflict situation, one of the, if you like, the plus sides of being in a country like that where things do not function like they do here, is that the social fabric and the community sense that there is amongst people is much more alive. And so out of necessity, and you know, they say that necessity is the mother of invention, necessity also bonds people together, gives them solidarity. For example, I've had situations where you're off on, they have these buses, they're called a Shiva, which is a lorry basically with wooden seats on the back. And this is used in a lot of the outlying rural areas, and it's the way in which everybody gets to town. And it'll run on market day. So a couple of times a week, everyone piles on the Shiva. And they will take down to town their coffee, their beans, whatever it is they're going to sell at market, animals and so on. And it's a social event, yeah? So travelling to town on market day is a big social event, and it's and everybody's chatting away and so on, yeah? So you've got that kind of thing there. But one of the things that I can see coming in Colombia now is that with the peace deal, they're bringing in more and more and more all of these things that there are here, where everybody's getting stuck on Facebook, on the mobile phones, you know, that, and it's, you know, there's a breakdown of that. It's fragmenting in a way, that community sense. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because you do sometimes get the impression that people are kind of talking to someone who's almost next to them, but they're talking on Facebook and on their phone rather than and typing things in rather than actually speaking to people face to face quite a lot. Anyway, look, let's just go back to these recent developments and the peace deal. $64,000 question. Is it going to work?
Depends which way, which angle you're looking at it from. What I've noticed out in Colombia and what's going on, you see, the guarantors of the peace deal are the United Nations. And what is being cranked up big time in Colombia now is that the NGOs are swarming into Colombia. So you've got everything from Médecins Sans Frontières, the Red Cross, and a whole gamut of smaller organisations which are coming into Colombia in order to implement courses in conflict resolution, in order to organise the people into different interest groups, human rights groups and all of this. Sounds all very nice, but when you actually look at what's really going on is that, and I heard a comment from one of the local person in Colombia, that the UN had organised a conference for farming communities to come along to be kind of told that they've now got human rights. And I heard, you know, one of the guys comment and it says, if we didn't have any before, what the fact is that, you know, the those communities, if you like, indigenous communities and in their roots, they've always had rights amongst them because to them life is sacred. And so every life has its right, yeah? They're being treated a bit as if they're kind of some kind of primitive beings who've never had even a notion of law and rights and all of that kind of thing.
A bit patronizing.
And now they're going to be ushered into sort of like the world of the UN with the Declaration of Human Rights and all of that kind of thing.
I mean, is there any hope, do you think, that big organisations like the UN can facilitate rather than lecture to actually help Colombians to set up their country in the way they want?
I think, in all honesty, I don't think that UN is actually formed in order to truly help anybody. I think that they've actually been formed. I mean, I've looked into the UN, and the UN was set up by the Rockefellers, I believe. Certainly the Rockefellers gave the UN its land, and all of the for example, in Haiti, what have the UN done in Haiti? They brought cholera there.
Yeah, we just had the admission, finally, more than 10 years after the event, that they actually were responsible for the deaths of something like 7,000 Haitians by spreading cholera from their little place there. They're so-called there to help people, but actually they ended up killing 7,000 people at least. So the United Nations needs to sort of do a bit of a rain check. They're certainly not very good at admitting when they get things wrong.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I think there's a big... There's a big situation for Colombian people now to deal with because of the existence of the guerrillas. One of the effects of the existence of the guerrillas is that it has limited tremendously the possibility for multinationals to get their hands on the abundant raw materials which are in Colombia, including now a lot of the new, a lot of names of different kind of minerals that people haven't heard of, which are used in the latest electronic developments. Yeah, so titanium is one. Titanium, I think. There's many, many different kinds of minerals now which are sought after. Colombia's also got two massive rivers, which there's a whole project to dam those rivers.
Well, it sounds to me almost as if the guerrillas, although they may have laid down their weapons, have they?
They are supposedly going to be giving their weapons to the UN.
Right.
Yeah, that's the deal. And I think the operative word in peace deal is deal. It's a deal, yeah? So it's obviously a negotiation that's gone on and a deal has been struck that we want such and so. If you actually read the different elements of the deal, a lot of them sound very good. And if they are going to be put into, for example, one of the main points of the deal has been how to deal with the problem of the drug trafficking. Because obviously a big, big element of the situation in Colombia is the drug situation of the cocaine, which is made in Colombia and exported to the United States and to Europe. Yeah. So this has been one of the major elements of the peace deal, is what is going to be done to deal with the situation of the production of cocaine in Colombia, and how is that going to be changed? So, you know, the guerrilla were putting forward the point of view of the rural people in Colombia, of the fact that the reason that people grow coca is because they don't have other viable options for making a living. So obviously you need to substitute what the coca gives with something else. So they're obviously talking about the creation of markets for different kind of products. Yeah, and ultimately the substitution of the production of coca. Yeah.
What about we're getting to the situation where mineral resources are being exploited in the next few years. Surely there's going to be a temptation, particularly if people are being cleared off their land, etc., to pick those guns up again.
It could well be the case. It all depends. I mean, I think a lot of the thing is in Colombia. I mean, I'm not per se against a peace. I'm very a lot of people in Colombia would be very skeptical about how this is actually going to function. But the people have been living in an internal conflict for more than 60 years. So you imagine if you're living in a place where so many people have been killed. I mean, over a million people at least have been killed in Colombia. There's 6 million displaced people. I mean, the toll that takes on a population, in which if you speak to people in Colombia, nearly everybody's been infected in some way by that conflict. I mean, you want peace, don't you? You don't want to live with the possibility that your son or your daughter's going to turn up dead on the doorstep, or that a family member's going to disappear, or that you're going to lose your home or your land. So it's obviously natural that people are going to want peace. Yeah, but what price are they going to pay for having that peace? This is the question.
Well, at the end of the day, you're right. I mean, you know, the drugs, what happens with the cocaine, the coca, is crucial in all of this. But, I mean, I wonder, is there – most of that cocaine, of course, is imported into the United States and sold in the United States.
It's all very well – I mean, you could
– are the U.S. serious about giving up that?
Well, the thing is
importation of cocaine?
Well, yeah, well, this is the question, because you can talk – it looks very lovely on paper, and the deal – on that aspect that I was reading through all of the points, and they're all very logical, but the point is that there's a demand for it, and if the demand is there, then somebody is going to supply it. And obviously we also know that the drugs trade is a big economic motor in the world, along with oil and guns.
Well, and also some of the big banks like HSBC have got, actually after the 2008 financial crisis, have gotten into the drugs trade. But anyway, I wonder, just, you know, do you think that the Americans are serious about giving up their addiction to cocaine? Because they're the cause of the demand.
I wasn't aware that they had said they were going to. I mean, we know, one story I heard of was a journalist from Los Angeles or San Francisco, one of those places, Gary Webb. Have you heard of him? He was killed, or apparently he killed himself, that is the story, although the investigations on that show that to be a bit dubious. But he had uncovered the CIA involvement in drug running. Yeah, so there's obviously very, very powerful interests in keeping the drugs moving. And, you know, we know from living in Colombia that although the Plan Colombia that was led up to the peace process, before the peace process, from the time of the Clinton administration, the US has put billions and billions of dollars into the Colombian military and into funding the fumigation of the coca fields. Yeah. But what had happened in practice is that after all of the years of that, the amount of land used to produce coca is the same as it was before. All that has happened is the areas where it's done has shifted, because they were going into certain areas where the FARC had control and they were fumigating in those areas. And so what would happen was that then the coca production would spring up in other areas, coincidentally areas that were under control of right-wing forces. Yeah, so it appeared more to be like a territory war rather than actually a real attempt to stop because, you know, like I say, if there's a demand for it, somebody is going to know that they're going to make some good money from it.
We like to blame the Americans for being the big place where there's a demand for cocaine, but actually, of course, that's not the case. Is equally a massive demand in Europe and many parts of the developed world for this drug.
It's also used in Colombia. I mean, you know, in the big cities all over the world now, you go to any big city and there's drugs available, aren't they? So,
I mean, I came across this, it's a really good audio book and a physical book called 000 by Roberto Saviano. He's actually under 24-hour guard with three carabinieri with him. He was a whistleblower from the drugs trade. He was actually one of the things he says in 000, and the reason he calls it that, the book, the title, is because this is the grade of the highest possible flour used for making pasta in Italy, and it's a kind of code for the very best cocaine.
Okay.
And I mean, he's saying actually that the city of London is the centre for this money laundering and this drugs trade. I mean, it's fairly shocking to some that Britain should actually be in the middle of this. But what do you make of that claim?
Oh, it wouldn't surprise me. I think that you know, it's quite obvious that the whole thing of high finance, for example, the city London is probably one of the most important financial centres in the world, if not the most important. I was listening to something the other day about the Fire of London and how the Fire of London has something to do with the creation of the City of London. because after the Fire of London, then that was created. So, you know, there's all where you have high finance, you have drugs, you have oil deals going on, you have arms deals going on, because what is it that they're the things that move the money? So where, you know, you've got all of this movement and money going on, it stands to reason that it would be a place where all of that's going on. I wouldn't be at all surprised.
Sounds to me like we haven't quite got a grip on the kind of mafia drug trade yet.
No, well, I think that it's endemic. It's endemic part of the modern world, because the modern world is... I mean, one of the things, for example, that I learned in Colombia, and I find it to be very important, is that, and rather ironic as well, is that the actual plant coca itself, in its natural form, for example, if you want to make 1 gram of cocaine, you need a huge sack of coca leaf, which means to say that in the coca leaf, only a very, very small percentage of the leaf is actually the alkaloid cocaine. Speaking to people out there who know their stuff on this, and people who've used it traditionally because it's medicinal, and it's also known as a sacred plant to indigenous peoples who hold it in very, very high regard, the coca plant. And they say, look, the white man or the Western people, they will isolate from the plant an active ingredient, yeah? And they said, but they don't realize that the passive ingredients of a plant are just as important as the active ones, and that in nature things are in balance. So in the sense, coca has actually got 14 different alkaloids in it, of which a cocaine is only one. And those alkaloids in the natural form balance out the things, so that when you use coca, you can use coca to drink tea, coca tea. You can chew, the traditional way that indigenous people use it is they chew it, either fresh or toasted. And that this, what it gives you is a gentle stimulant. It is a very strong cup of coffee is stronger in the way that it affects your nervous system and so on. You know, you don't get the shakes if you chew coca. It gives people a kind of a relaxed, but it keeps them aware, but they're relaxed. Yeah, so it doesn't kind of overstimulate, and it's actually very good for you because it contains different minerals and different vitamins, which can be absorbed into the blood whilst you're chewing it.
So are you one of these people that went over to Colombia originally just to get some access to these drugs?
I wouldn't call them drugs myself. I didn't. I went over to study indigenous learn about indigenous medicine, because these plants are truly medicinal. Coca leaf, for example, for little children in Colombia, one of the problems, health problems in Colombia that's very common for little children is amoebic dysentery. 3, 4, or 5 coca leaves boiled up in milk will be given to little babies there, and in general in South America, and it cures and gets rid of the parasites. That's one use for it. It fortifies the gums and the teeth. It oxygenates the blood. So, for example, in places like Bolivia, where you have the Altiplano, which is often like over 3,500 meters above sea level, it's very common to get lack of oxygen to the brain, which causes altitude sickness.
So this is herbal medicine,
really? A cup of coca tea oxygenates the blood because it helps the capillaries in the lungs to open up. Well, so it's not a drug.
It's herbal medicine. It's not a drug. What you're describing sounds to me like a kind of herbal medicine, but the drug companies aren't going to make anything selling that to you if you can grow it in your garden.
Well, exactly. And this is, I think, because one of the things that to me was a glaring omission in the deal that they've made on the particular part of the coca is they're talking about substituting the coca, i.e. eradicating the plant. Yeah. But they don't talk about the possibility of allowing people to continue to grow the plant, but just to change its use. Because you can make shampoo. In Bolivia, for example, they've legalized the production of coca bush against the advice of the United Nations, because the United Nations were the ones who made coca illegal in 1954. And the coca leaf is classified as if it was cocaine. Yeah, but coca leaf is not cocaine.
Well,
by any stretch.
One other group of people that rather like these things being made illegal is the mafia, because then they can have a whole massive illegal market in it, and suddenly the profits jump.
The profits jump, exactly, because if it were to be, I mean, cocaine originally was legal. There is the one company in the world that is actually legally allowed to use coca leaf. Can you guess what that one is? Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola are legally allowed to import into the United States a certain number of tons of coca leaf per year, because by law, in order to call the product Coca-Cola, they have to have some derivative of coca in their recipe. I think they only use some kind of extract, but they have to do it by law. So there is an exception made for the Coca-Cola company, and they're allowed to use coca leaf. But the indigenous peoples who have used it for thousands of years without any kind of drug problem, because it's not a drug to them, yeah, they're not allowed to.
So I wonder if any of these Coca-Cola employees are actually cokeheads as well, and they're using some of this cocaine, refined cocaine.
Oh, I'm sure they're not.
Anyway, Chris Pothekeri, I wish you a very safe trip back, and hopefully we'll have you back when you're back in the UK, or maybe we could even have a chat to you on Skype if you're able to do that sort of thing from one of your internet
cafes.
Yeah,
well, it'd be good to keep abreast of what goes on there, and I think it's going to be a very interesting time in Colombia.
I just wonder if you've got anywhere you point people online to get news about Colombia, because we just simply don't get it all the time online.
Well, I'm actually working at the moment on some articles to start up a blog, and the blog is going to be with the address beyondthefrontier@wordpress.com. So I've set up the blog. I haven't actually published anything on it yet, but I'm going to be doing so in the next week or so.
Well,
so
we'll keep track of your
activities. I think the idea is to use that as a way, and I've been in contact with various other sort of people in alternative media, so I'm hoping to be able to set something up and to be able to sort of like communicate regularly from there and keep people up to date with what's going on in Colombia.
Okay, Chris Pothekeri, thanks very much for joining us again on Dialect.
Thanks very much, Tony.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Chris Pothekeri, talking about Colombia, and Fran Anderson from reinvestigate911.org. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. And anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on prsc.org.uk. Also via Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk, or the national volunteering website, that's do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.